Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space. We thank our studio audience, people who've come down to see the show live in the Green Space this morning. We thank the Jerome L. Green Foundation, as always. And you heard the Indivisible promo during that break. Tonight, I'll be hosting our national call-in show, Indivisible, at 8 o'clock with a President's Week special, the first month of the Trump administration, through the eyes of presidential historian Douglas Brinkley and NPR's Cokie Roberts and callers from around the country. So join me tonight at 8. Right now, we are so lucky that our Green Space show coincidentally comes during President's Week because we were able to invite a group of teachers down here to talk broadly about education, something we like to do on school holidays. And in the context of today's news, education at the dawn of the Betsy DeVos era. We also have, as my partner for this segment, NPR's lead education blogger, lead digital education correspondent, Anya Kamenetz, author of several books, including Generation Debt, DIYU, EduPunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education, and most recently, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Hi, Anya. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Brian.
And with us here at the Green Space, sitting in the front row, hybrid audience members and guests, are Patrick James Walsh, an ESL teacher at Sojourner Truth School, that's PSMS 149, a K-8 public school in Harlem. Patrick has been at Sojourner for 13 years. He's also his school's union rep. Ariel Sachs, who teaches 8th grade English at the Renaissance Charter School, which is a pre-K through 12 public charter school in Jackson Heights. She's been a teacher for 13 years and has been at Renaissance for the past three. And she tells us the school serves a large special ed population as well as many immigrants and English language learners. Annalise Silivanch teaches English and debate to 10th through 12th graders at Abraham Clark High School in Roselle, New Jersey, and she has a child herself at a charter school in Morristown. Sante Mastriana teaches 9th and 10th grade ESL in global history and is the testing coordinator for the Bronx Latin School, which serves 6th through 12th graders in the Bronx. This is third year I see at Bronx Latin. Candace Simon teaches 6th grade at Brooklyn Collaborative, which is a New York City Outward Bound 6th through 12th school in Carroll Gardens. Her 10th year teaching at the school began in 2001 in education through the New York City Teaching Fellows Program. And Marissa Krohn, special ed teacher at PS 23, a K through 5 elementary school in is it 23 or is it 234? 234. Somebody left out the 4 on my script, but I know that school. This school has 750 students across grade levels with about 20% special ed students, and she has taught there for 7 years. So great to have all of you here. Thank you very much for spending part of your school holiday with us. Should we just go down the row here and, you know, call the roll a little bit? Patrick, what's the best and worst part of your job?
The best part of my job is dealing with immigrant children who are lovely. The worst part of my job is dealing with the bureaucracy.
Ariel, want to take a crack at that?
Sure. The best part of my job is definitely working with the students and just being a part of their lives and also figuring out how to empower them. And the worst part of my job, I think, is just the kind of the rigidity of the way that the role and the career of a teacher is laid out. I think, you know, we're part of a long-term struggle to become a true profession, and right now it's just still a little bit too rigid and standardized the way that our work life is set up.
Give the mic back to Patrick for a second, and I want to ask you what part of the bureaucracy you were thinking of as most getting in your way as a teacher.
Well, we have been totally stripped of autonomy as teachers, which is one of the reasons we have been largely stripped of creativity, we have been, how can I put this, to a great extent shackled to the place where I was asked by a dear friend of mine whose child was thinking about going into education, that should she do it? And sadly, I had to say no.
So. Sante, best and worst parts of your job?
Hands down, the best part of my job is working with the students. I won't say it's the worst part. The hardest part of my job is also working with the students. But the worst part of my job is, unfortunately, despite the fact...
We could tell that he teaches 10th through 12th grade.
Yeah.
Though might have guessed middle school, but go ahead.
Despite the fact that my school as a public school is succeeding in ways that many other in New York City are not, the worst part of the job is experiencing firsthand the extent to which the public education system, whether implemented through charter schools or public schools, anyone would acknowledge, is objectively not meeting the needs of modern society. And experiencing that firsthand and seeing how...
What does that mean?
Well, we have a lot of policies in place, both officially and just kind of in our culture, that, well, you know, everyone needs to go to college and we need to do all these, you know, academics and all of it. But it's still rooted in this idea that, well, if you go to college, you get a job. And that's simply not true anymore. And would I ever suggest that my students shouldn't go to college? Absolutely not. Absolutely. If they can make something of themselves, they should. But we are circumscribing their prospects in a way that is not meeting the demands of what the world is really like.
Annalise, your turn. Best and worst.
Well, the best part of my job is also the students. I teach three sections of debate every day. And they are curious and complex. They're at a turning point in their lives. One of my students got a $20,000 scholarship to the new school, and it's a Title I school, so it was very exciting. I love asking them what they want to learn about next, because our list is very long for the rest of the year. The worst part of my job, well, the state was in our school all day on Friday, and boy, we were exhausted.
What were they doing?
Just a regular check, sort of visiting classrooms, and the goals are really noble and helpful. But I had a student say to me, "Miss, they were hanging over me in class," and you know, just it's a different feel in the school for the day. And well, I wouldn't say that's the worst part of my job. You know, maybe it's the late nights grading, but you know, certainly it's part of what we're dealing with.
Candace, yeah. How about you?
The best part of my job is the students as well, and being privileged to teach in a school that is not focused on the test and where teachers get to write a lot of their own curriculum and looking for culturally relevant topics to teach and preparing students to be civic-minded and being geared towards social justice. And the worst part of my job is probably teaching pubescent middle schoolers.
Marissa?
Not to be repetitive, but to echo everyone else, the best part is the students. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't laugh at something a student has said or just find some enjoyment in spending time with them. And then the worst part, I would echo the bureaucracy, but from a separate part outside of, I think I'm privileged to be in a school that grants me a lot of autonomy and creativity and being able to do what I need to do. But I would say that there is that kind of icky paperwork piece of it that I think as a profession we're not really granted the respect of time and space to do that and to get it done in a way that feels comprehensive and thoughtful.
So Anya Kamenetz, NPR education reporter, I think on the worst part side, down the row, we heard a limit to their autonomy, a limit to their ability to teach without the bureaucracy getting in the way of everything and micromanaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my book, The Test, really delved into the history of how we got here, where over the last 15 or 16, now 20 years of education policy, there's been this accountability culture that's come in to say, and what underlies that, I think, is a culture of not trusting teachers as much, right? Why do we need all of these checks? Why do we need standardized tests for every grade? Because people don't trust teachers, they don't empower teachers, they don't train teachers, they don't give them the ability to actually get out there and teach, which is what the best performing school systems in the world do.
But if we look at it from a 15-year sweep of policy, which is the time frame that you just kind of laid out, you know, we had George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind, which tried to establish accountability school by school, including the success at closing race and income disparities within the school.
Right.
Obama's Race to the Top aimed for a different kind of accountability with the standardized test results, counting for more. 15 years later, has the government accomplished anything, in your view, as a reporter who's been studying this, even if the teachers don't like it, in closing educational disparities?
I think most people will say that it's a good thing that we're talking about, you know, achievement gaps and reporting out the performance of different groups that might have been swept under the rug before. On the negative side, we have our minds around the problem. But on the negative side, you know, just as the door was shutting, the Obama administration's Department of Ed put out a report saying our school improvement grant program, that $3 billion program, the biggest education grant program ever created under Race to the Top, had null results. There were no results, positive results in school turnaround, in school closure. So we really are at a blank slate moment, which is so fascinating because we're making such a hairpin turn in policy and kind of saying that none of that stuff really did very much. I mean, there are certainly changes around the edges. No one would say that there's no progress, but.
What's the Betsy DeVos hairpin turn? Is it vouchers primarily, which is what's been in the news?
I think what's extreme about DeVos and her record is really a culture of, you know, not just lamenting the problems of failing public schools, but really saying there's no use in public schools, that we're going to, as much as we can, leave those behind and create either charter schools that are for-profit, that have relatively little accountability. She, you know, she was very clear, and she's repeated it since in her confirmation hearings and to the press, that she doesn't think that all schools that receive federal money should be held to the same accountability standards. And so she's praised programs such as in Florida, where state money goes to schools that are not subject to the same rules. So it really is privatization. I think that's the word that best fits it.
I think we have a clip of her from her confirmation hearings with Senator Maggie Hassan to this exact point.
Individual with Disabilities and Education Act. That's a federal civil rights law. So do you stand by your statement a few minutes ago that it should be up to the states whether to follow it?
The law must be followed. Federal law must be followed where federal dollars are in play.
So were you unaware when I just asked you about the IDEA that it was a federal law?
I may have confused it.
Marissa, you're a special ed teacher here.
Yes. Yes.
What does she need to go to school on?
So many things. I think that was alarming. And I think, like I said, as much as the paperwork can be what we call like the paperwork can be burdensome, I know that in reality it serves a greater purpose to make sure that I'm doing my job in a way that feels appropriate and well-serving to the students that I'm serving. So I think to hear someone so thoughtlessly disregard that the fact a law even exists to allow inclusion and mandate inclusion is really concerning from the perspective as a special ed professional, but also from the perspective as an educator that believes in intellectual curiosity and research.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back with our six teachers, let's do a little thought experiment. What if we went to a complete voucher system in the United States? What if all the families could get the same amount of money that the combination of local, state, and federal government is spending on them at your public schools, and schools would have to compete for their dollars? We're going to get these six teachers' point of view on that. Imagine that alternative future. And Anya Kamenetz from NPR. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer live from the Green Space on WNYC. WNYC live from the Green Space today with our panel of six public school teachers from around the New York area. And that includes district schools and charter schools from schools in New York and New Jersey. I'm not going to go through everybody's specific IDs again, or it would take the rest of our time. But also with us, Anya Kamenetz, the lead digital education reporter for NPR. By the way, Anya, you came in saying that there's a little breaking education news today having to do with transgender kids policy.
This hasn't been completely confirmed. I'm going to say that. But we have seen that. So the Obama administration took steps last year to expand transgender student rights under Title IX. It's being reported that the Trump administration may be rolling that back. Attorney General Sessions has already taken steps to stay the order, the case that had been pursued by his predecessor. So that's something that we're watching.
So teachers, as a thought experiment, what if we had a total voucher system? Assume for the moment the best possible voucher system. All the money spent per pupil today goes to that family to spend on a school. Schools are private and compete for those vouchers. You would still be employable as teachers, presumably. Would that give us better or worse urban education for poor kids, which is who most of you teach, than we have today? Who wants it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll take it. I think if you want a window into what a universally voucher system, which Michigan is not, but it is one of the closest examples we have,
DeVos.
So being outside of Michigan, it's hard to understand how much influence and power the DeVos family really has. But if you actually look into their record, I went through an article by Kate Czernicki at the New York Times. It was published last year in June. She kind of broke down all of the problems that Michigan has experienced as a direct result of DeVos's influence, which is expanding school vouchers, deregulating charter schools, to the point that Michigan's charter schools are now 80% for-profit companies. This means that they have a direct profit motive to recruit students, and they operate in the same way. They have these things called count day competitions, where it's, well, if you come to our school, your kid gets a laptop and an iPod. And it's like, it reminds me of those when we were in school and they would make us sell like the candies or whatever, so you would win the little prizes and really it was nothing.
Were able to compete because they want to make money, and Candace, I'll let you in to answer this follow-up question. These for-profit schools want to make some money, and therefore they're going to have to prove to their customers that they're the best at what they do, and they're going to give you the laptops and, oh, we have these test scores or whatever else they want to advertise. Why wouldn't that be good?
I think what's scary for me about the vouchers is that even if all families got the same amount of money, schools cost, these private schools will have their own tuition, and some families that are more wealthy will be able to send their kids to those schools with the voucher or pay in excess of what the voucher allows, and the families that are poor will not be able to pay that. That's
exactly the argument that they use for a voucher system now, because the families without money are relegated to usually the neighborhood public schools, which might be terrible.
Right, and maybe there won't be any neighborhood private schools, and families won't be able to get their kids to those private schools that are better. So I just think fundamentally it's really problematic and will create the kind of segregation that we fought long ago to not have.
You wanted in on this?
Yeah. I think this would be a nightmare. I am a believer in public life, in public works, and in the public good. We are not made to rip each other's throats out from kindergarten to the grave. I have seen this kind of thing in the charter wars in Harlem. It is ugly. It is brutal. It destroys neighborhoods. It destroys friendships. And it improves nothing, excepting the bank accounts of hedge funders and whoever else, whatever edupreneurs are on the grab.
Ariel, you teach at a charter school, right?
I do. I mean, we're different than some other charter schools because we're a hub of the community. We started out as a district school and voted 5 years in to become charter school. So that was like 20 years ago. I may not have the year exact. And we remained in the UFT, so we're a unionized faculty. So I think the problem that I see with going to vouchers would be kind of resegregation, or really a further segregation. We have a problem with segregated schools here in New York City now because we do have a fair amount of school choice built into our system. And so, through charters and also through just the ability to go to a school that's not your neighborhood school. So we have people sorting themselves.
What's the upside then of your school as a charter school?
I would say I've taught in both public schools and charter schools. And I mean, I think we have a bit more flexibility than some public schools when it comes to curriculum, how we use our funds, how we evaluate teachers. But it is like a constant negotiation with the state rather than with the city. So that's a difference. So I would say, though, in a lot of ways, when it comes to schools, it's who's in charge, really.
And Annalise, you teach
it's not that different.
At a regular public school in Roselle, New Jersey, but you have a child at a charter school in Morristown. Do you have a basis for comparison then through your two experiences?
I do. And by the way, New Jersey does not allow for-profit charters. So we are strictly nonprofit and publicly owned charters. And I think that's the perfect middle ground for me, because I think, as Ariel is saying, it's a charter school that can be flexible. Unity Charter has been operating for 18 years. It's one of the oldest. And because it's small, it's only 234 kids. The flexibility around the charter and things they can try. They do democratic governance. They do positive discipline. It's, you know, it's like a dream school. But it's a public lottery. It's accessible. And so I think we need schools like that to show other schools where the problems are in public education. Like, for instance, I really think that public schools have a values problem, right? We teach kids to protect the environment, and then we send them down the hall to go use disposable everything in the cafeteria. So I think we need little schools like Unity to be laboratories to show how it can be done and if it can be done.
We just have about 30 seconds left in the program. Anya Kamenetz, what's the debate to come? Is it going to be, you know, the Republican Congress and Trump and DeVos putting through some kind of massive federal voucher system? Or what are the real political parameters of this? Can you tell?
I think the fascinating point that we're at right now is that the people in charge at the federal level don't want federal authority. And so the reauthorization of I know that sounds strange, but the reauthorization of Every Student Succeeds Act was about giving more power to the states and more power to localities. And now they're moving even farther in that direction. So honestly, I think it's going to be way up to our teachers and the local level of education. We're going to see exactly how powerful that can be.
Anya Kamenetz, lead education blogger for NPR. And thanks to the six of you who came from schools all over the area. Thank you so, so much. Thanks to our entire great audience here at the Green Space. Thanks, everybody, for coming. And thanks, everybody, listening for listening. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tonight at 8 on Indivisible.